This morning we'll be looking at Isaiah chapters 46 and 47, and the Lord goes into a lengthy discussion on the futility of idols, and that's the kind of the title of the sermon this morning. And as we go through it, I'm actually going to read the scripture as we go along. So I've divided it into three parts, and so each part there'll be a reading of the text for each part. But what or who is the most important thing or person in your life? What consumes most of your time? Does this object or person take up more of your time and thoughts than of God and everything related to God? If so, then that thing or person could be your idol. Idolatry is defined as the worship of an idol or a cult image or a person, being a physical image such as a statue or a person in place of God. One of the greatest, most prevalent idols of our day is in everyone's possession at this very moment. It's either in your hand or on the table in front of you or maybe beside you on the couch or the arm of the chair. Maybe it's in your pocket or in your purse. If you haven't guessed, it's your mobile phone. The phone and technology has become an idol for this day and age. It's carried everywhere we go, causing some people to walk into closed doors or into signposts or even to fall into fountains because they're not paying attention to what they're doing. We can watch shows, we can play games, read books, buy anything we want, pay our bills, and access all kinds of knowledge, good or bad. Yes, of course, there are still the traditional idols. Statues of millions of deities, prayer wheels, candles, carved images in wood, stone, metal, paintings and depictions of gods and goddesses, temples and altars. All of this is still very much used in false worship today, but anything that takes the place of our worship of God is an idol. You know, I had a friend whose parents smoked cigarettes. They smoked all day long. My mom didn't like me going into their house because of how I smelled when I came home. The father, he was diagnosed with lung cancer from a lifetime of smoking, who knows, at least 2 packs a day, if not more. He never stopped smoking. You never saw him without a cigarette. His cancer treatments did nothing for him since he continued to abuse himself. He never stopped. The addiction was an obsession, which really was an idolatry. The cigarettes were his idol. The idol was his failure, and it caused his destruction. And that is the basis of these two chapters. It is a discussion of the effects of idol worship. Worshiping something inanimate will fail you every time. You're doomed for failure, and that failure leads to destruction, total ruin. There is only one way out, only one plan of salvation, and that is in the Lord. He is the one and only God, and through his Son, Jesus Christ, salvation is promised. So let me read the first section. It is Isaiah chapter 46, verses 1 to 7. Bel bows down, and Nebo stoops. Their idols are on beasts and livestock. These things you carry are borne as burdens on weary beasts. They stoop, they bow down together. They cannot save the burden, but themselves go into a captivity. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel, who have been born by me from before your birth, carried from the womb. Even to your old age I am he, and to gray hairs I will carry you. I have made and I will bear. I will carry and will save. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me, that we may be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh out silver in the scales, they hire a goldsmith and he made it into a god. Then they fell down and worship. They lift it to their shoulders, they carry it, they set it in its place, and it stands there. It cannot move from its place. If one cries to it, it does not answer or save him from his trouble. Now, knowing cultural context makes a world of difference. Let me explain an American sport. Let me explain it by telling you about an American sport. Before the game starts, I used the fungo so the fielders could shag a few flies. When the game started, the pitcher shook off the signs on an 0-2 count, threw a splitter, and the batter whiffed. The catcher then threw the ball around the horn while the man on deck approached the plate. Now, you probably have no clue as to what I just said. It's just like me listening to Weeshie Fogarty describing a football match while we were still in the U.S. and I didn't have a clue what he was describing. I described hitting baseballs to the fielders before a baseball game, just to give them some practice. Then I described the pitcher striking out the first batter, throwing the ball past the batter, and the batter swung and missed, and the catcher throwing the ball around the infield to each of the players. It was kind of a ritualistic thing to do. You get the first guy out and you throw the ball around. It's called throwing it around the horn. Without knowing the culture and the history of baseball, you just didn't know what I was talking about. Well, that's what we have here in these first two verses of chapter 46. God gave Israel a vision of a cultural event in Babylon. And what is described here is the annual parade of the two main deities of Babylon, Bel and Nebo, or Nabu, or there's two or three versions of his name, but Nebo. Bel was the patron god of Babylon. Belshazzar used Bel in his name to show that he was connected with the gods. Nebo was considered the eldest son of Bel, and his function was to write in the tablet of destiny what the gods decreed for the coming year. Nebuchadnezzar took his name as part of his own. Now, every year at the New Year festival, the two gods were carried in the streets in a procession. They're each taken from their own shrine, and their effigies being carried, similar to parade floats, through the streets of Babylon, ending in the great shrine of Isagila. Now, while we know nothing of this, unless we researched it, the exiles would have witnessed this every year that Babylon was in power. This context also helps us understand chapter 45, verse 20, when God said, "They have no knowledge who carry about their wooden idols." He's talking about this parade. These wooden idols being carried about were Bel and Nebo, empty gods that validated an empty culture based on empty worship. And verse 20 goes on to say, they keep on praying to a god that cannot save. The image of the parade is focused on those who are carrying these idols. The idols are a burden, weighing down those carrying them as if they were beasts. They are like pack animals, barely able to sustain the weight that they carry. Now compare their idols to God. This comparison is always foolishness, but we as silly humans, we need to be reminded time and again. Compare these lumps of wood with the Holy One of Israel. What has he done? God says, listen to me. Pay attention. I created you. I birthed you. You who are a ragtag people, I made a nation. I have known you from your beginning, and I will know you at your ending. I will carry you. I made you, and I will bear you during the darkest times of your lives. I will carry you, and I will save. God knows that they are within the belly of the beast, so to speak. They cannot help but see and witness these pagan rituals. They must stay focused on God and remember and trust that he will always sustain them. He will always carry them, bear them up, and save them. Psalm 55:22 says, cast your cares on the Lord and he will sustain you. He will never let the righteous be shaken. And also Psalm 68:19 says, praise be to the Lord, to God our Savior, who daily bears our burdens. God is our salvation. There is no comparison between God and the idols of silver or gold. How can man, even for a moment, think that something he melted down and created in a crude fashion could be equal to the creator of all things, including the shiny metal used for the idol? God created that as well. God describes to Isaiah the image of a rich man hiring a goldsmith to make an idol from the metals. The gold and silver is weighed out and given to the goldsmith. When the idol's ready, the rich man immediately bows down and worships it. You know, he did not worship the raw silver and gold in his bag when he brought it in. But now that the craftsman has shaped that into some image, the rich man thinks it is now worthy of his worship. And he proceeds to carry it home, setting it in place just like the parade of gods through Babylon. He sets it in its place where it's never going to move unless it's knocked over. If the man cried out, God says it does not answer or save him from his trouble. And when Cyrus the Great and his Medo-Persian army swoops in and destroys Babylon, no amount of crying will help. Bel and Nebo will stand there, motionless, as Babylon is defeated. That is the failure of idol worship, believing in something other than the living God. Without God, nothing is possible. Now let's step back a moment and remind ourselves of Israel's situation and who he is writing to. Remember that he lived through the Assyrian invasion and the siege of Jerusalem. He was an eyewitness to that historical event. His warnings in chapters 1 to 39 were relevant for that particular time, as well as looking forward in time to the exile, to the birth of the promised Messiah, and to the end of days even. But now chapters 40 to 55, he is giving messages of comfort and hope to the exiles. He is writing to people not yet born in his time. Now the exile took place about 100 years after the events of chapters 36 to 39. This alone is a proof that God is greater than the idols of Babylon, the false silent gods that weighed down a society. See, God named Cyrus as his instrument of freedom for his people decades before Cyrus was born. God knew. God had a plan. God also knew the exiles would be in Babylon for 70 years, surrounded by these pagan rituals and worship of Bel, Nebo, Marduk, and many other false gods. And these two chapters is God's way of saying that this is important. Please be cautious. Don't get caught up in the hysteria of the local deities. Stay focused on me. These gods can do nothing but sit on the shelf. It's kind of like Elf on the Shelf. They just sit on the shelf. They do nothing. But the devotion and ritualistic worship of such idols, they can destroy people. And this is what chapter 47 is all about. It's the destruction of a society that rejects the true God and devotes themselves to the lives of false gods who cannot save. So let me read chapter 47. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For you shall no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind flour. Put off your veil. Strip off your robe. Uncover your legs. Pass through the rivers. Your nakedness shall be uncovered, and your disgrace shall be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will spare no one. Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, is the Holy One of Israel. Sit in silence and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called the mistress of kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. I gave them into your hand. You showed them no mercy. On the aged, you made your yoke exceedingly heavy. You said, I shall be mistress forever, so that you did not lay these things to heart or remember their end. Now therefore, hear this, you lover of pleasures, who sit securely, who say in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. I shall not sit as a widow or know the loss of children. Well, these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day. The loss of children and widowhood shall come upon you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries and the great power of your enchantments. You felt secure in your wickedness, and you said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge led you astray. You said in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. But evil shall come upon you, which you will not know how to charm away. Disaster shall fall upon you, for which you will not be able to atone, and ruin shall come upon you suddenly, of which you know nothing. Stand fast in your enchantments and your many sorceries, from which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you may be able to succeed. Perhaps you may inspire terror. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let them stand forth and save you. Those who divide the heavens, who gaze at the stars, who at the new moons made known what shall come upon you. Behold, they are like stubble. The fire consumes them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. No coal for warming oneself is this. No fire to sit before. Such to you are those with whom you have labored, who have done business with you from your youth. They wander about, each in his own direction. There is no one to save you. So let's look at this section in three parts. You have the fall of Babylon, you have the reason for the fall, which was pride, and you have the ultimate helplessness of the society. First, in verses 1-6, we see the fall of Babylon. When you hear of Babylon, there are two versions. You have the literal city and nation of Babylon. Then you have the figurative idea of Babylon. Now, the figurative Babylon is how the world is represented. Anything that is against God is Babylon. Babylon is the epitome of anti-God behavior. Thus, quote-unquote, Babylon is a symbolic meaning of the world's system under satanic domination. Idol worship, pride, arrogance, ruthlessness, no mercy are ideals that made Babylon who they were, and it caused the destruction of Babylon. The prediction of the fall of Babylon is in this chapter is relative to every generation of human history. And in verses 1-3, Babylon is described as a young, pampered, self-indulgent, spoiled girl who always gets her way, yet is now in shock because of her own disgrace. She is no longer the mistress of kingdoms, but will be forced to do the labor of a common slave, working the millstone to grind flour. This degrading demotion of status will be from God alone, our Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the Lord of hosts. He will be the one to take a vengeance, and he will spare no one. All are guilty. God gave Israel to Babylon. Babylon was God's instrument of judgment upon his people. But Babylon went too far. God allowed Babylon to take them, yet Babylon showed no mercy on an already defeated people. So God brought his vengeance upon them. And secondly, we see the pride of Babylon in verses 7-11. Notice verse 7, I shall be mistress forever. They were lovers of pleasure. They said that I am, and there is no one besides me. Does that sound familiar? They wanted to be like God. Nothing has changed since the temptation in the Garden of Eden to that time in Babylon, and nothing will change today or in the future until Jesus returns. Man's pride and arrogance, saying, I want to be like God, I am God, will be his downfall. Verse 10 says, you felt secure in your wickedness, saying, no one sees me. And again, repeating, I am, and there is no one besides me. But what did they rely on? They relied on their sorceries, their enchantments, their worldly wisdom and knowledge. They were found lacking. In a moment, in one day, everything they knew would be gone. God would give them over to the Medes and Persians. We know from Daniel 5, the events of that very night. Belshazzar blasphemed the Lord by using cups and vessels from God's temple in a pagan party. The hand of God wrote words on the wall. The king's wise men, enchanters, magicians, and astrologers could not decipher the meaning. Daniel was called in, and he said, and this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Paris, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, and a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That was Belshazzar's promise before he knew what this meant. But yet that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Man's pride versus God's righteousness. God wins every time. In a publication by the American Humanist Association, they said that ethics did not need a theological basis. Human life has meaning because we create and we develop our futures. According to them, it's all about them and nothing about God. God is left out of the equation. That is the world's ideals. That was Babylon's ideals. Now compare that to a song that we sing. It's all about you, Jesus. And all this is for you. For your glory and your fame, it's not about me. As if you should do things my way. You alone are God, and I surrender to your ways. So which of these two viewpoints do you believe is true to reality, and which is a lie? Which one brings you to destruction, and which one will bring you to salvation? Thirdly, we see the hopelessness of Babylon in verses 12 to 15. The harsh reality of idol worship is that the person devoted to an inanimate object is lost in a sea of hopelessness. These verses are incredibly sad verses. They describe people who are totally devoted to a carved piece of wood or stone. They're lost in the rituals of enchantment, sorcery, astrology, and they're trying to do good works to appease a god that cannot save itself, even if it's dropped into the fire. The lump of wood will burn and the god will be ashes. There is a foreboding sense of helplessness and hopelessness as they wander about, each in his own direction. There is no one to save you. Idol worship not only destroys the culture, it destroys the peace of mind and the soul. It leaves an emptiness inside you that can never be filled, except if someone turns to the one true God. Turn to me and be saved, all ye nations, for I am God, and there is no other. Now let me read the remaining portion of our text this morning, which is chapter 46, verses 8 to 13. Remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my counsel from a far country, I have spoken and I will bring it to pass. I have purposed and I will do it. Listen to me, you stubborn of heart, and you who are far from righteousness, I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay. I will put salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. Within God's discussion and warning of idol worship, God provides the hope of salvation. As he warns his people who are in exile of the destructive forces of idol worship. As he warns them about that, he reminds them of the saving power of his grace. Words of comfort within words of warning. God knows his people are being swayed by false idols and religions because they are surrounded by it. God calls them out for being transgressors, stubborn of heart, wandering far from righteousness. He tells them to turn around, come back, remember. Remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind. Remember the former things of old. Listen to me. Israel has always been a stubborn child, and God is calling them out in a loving way to get their attention before they do things that they should not do. You know, there's an old song we sing from time to time by William Cowper. Let me read the poem it's based on. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and he rides upon the storm. You fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. God is saying, remember all that I have brought you through. Remember why you are here. Remember that I promised to bring you home and to renew, to restore your lives. Don't get caught up in the craziness of Babylon, but stay focused on me. Stay focused on truth. Stay focused on my righteousness. God reminds them of who he is. I am God and there is no other. There is none like me. He is not a carved piece of wood. He's not a crafted metal. He's not an image or an icon. He is the living and true God. God is reminding them that he knows all things and he's sovereign. He was from the beginning to the present. He has spoken of things from ancient times and he speaks of things yet to happen. As a reminder, he has mentioned Cyrus, which is that bird of prey from the east. God has already told them who will be his instrument of peace for them. It's someone not yet born. And he has given them glimpses of the coming Messiah. And he's told them of the end of days when all nations will come together in Jerusalem to praise and worship God together. He says, I have spoken and I will bring it to pass. I have purposed and I will do it. It's all God or it's nothing. If God can't do it, then he's not God. God has said it. He will do it. End of discussion. You know, God ends this with, listen to me. You people are stubborn. You've lost your focus. Turn your attention back to me. Put blinders on and don't look at the false images around you. Just stay focused on me, on my righteousness. I'm always here. I'm always near. It is you who wander off. It's not me. So stay close. I am mighty to save. I provide you the hope, the salvation that these people around you cannot find in their idols. They are lost in their sin of idolatry. I provide salvation for all who believe in me. I provide the victory. I will put salvation in Zion. And that salvation is the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Now, Paul wrote about this in Romans 10. And this is kind of a longer section, 8 to 17, but I feel led to read it. And Paul wrote, but what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we proclaim. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and you believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. For the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. More and more, we are feeling like exiles. Our movements are restricted. We fear an enemy that we cannot see. We are surrounded by worldly wisdom and people believing that they have power within themselves to make themselves better. We are restricted in our meeting together as a church. We are now restricted in meeting with anyone at all. And it might even be stricter. During this time, what will become your idol? Will you allow your mind and thoughts to stray to something other than the Lord? Will you be consumed with something online or on TV, or will you be focused on the Lord? You know, Ann said it best Wednesday night Bible study, that we need to stay focused on the Bible, on God's Word. We need to make that a priority. The psalmist did, from my favorite psalm, the opening stanza of Psalm 119. Blessed are those whose way is blameless, who walk in the way in the law of the Lord. Blessed are those who keep his testimonies, who seek him with their whole heart, who also do no wrong but walk in his ways. You have commanded your precepts to be kept diligently. Oh, that my ways may be steadfast in keeping your statutes. Then I shall not be put to shame, having my eyes fixed on all your commandments. I will praise you with an upright heart when I learn your righteous rules. I will keep your statutes. Do not utterly forsake me. Let us all walk in the law of the Lord and seek him with our whole heart. Let's not be swayed by any fear of any or any worldly wisdom, but let us stay close to the living God who brings us salvation. Let's close by singing the first verse of Victory in Jesus.